Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 27th of June. Our main stories: Italy says it won't allow 42 migrants rescued in the Mediterranean to disembark at one of its ports. A UN human rights expert calls for the Saudi crown prince to be investigated over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. And a warning of climate apartheid as global warming widens the gap between rich and poor. Also in this podcast:
an agreement requires that this Chinese firm be compensated. So if you add that amount to the costs that are already sunk, and you think about the interest rates that Kenya is paying together with the principal amounts, it's unlikely that this railway line is ever going to break even.
Why Kenya's Chinese-backed railway is hemorrhaging money, and the Japanese animation film breaking box office records in China. A year ago, Italy's new populist government sparked a heated row in Europe by refusing to allow a Mediterranean rescue boat into its ports. The Aquarius, which was carrying more than 600 mostly African migrants, eventually docked in Spain. Well, now, after 2 weeks at sea, another charity-run vessel has defied official warnings and entered Italian territorial waters around the island of Lampedusa. The Italian Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, said he would use every lawful means to stop what he called an outlaw ship. But a spokesman for the vessel, Sea-Watch 3, Chris Gradotsky, told the BBC they were complying with international law.
We are acting in full accordance with the law of the sea, with the Geneva Refugee Convention, and we will continue to do so, and we will continue to save lives in the Mediterranean. We have stopped talking to Minister Salvini because obviously he's not interested in any productive communication about the issue.
I heard more about the standoff from our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
The Sea-Watch 3 picked up 53 migrants on the 12th of June in waters north of Libya. 11 of those were evacuated, including a couple of pregnant women. The migrants now are mainly sub-Saharan migrants from the Ivory Coast, Cameroon, some North African people as well from Libya and Egypt. Now the question is what happens to them? And Mr. Salvini has said that they cannot disembark. The migrants themselves have said, what do we have to do to get a safe port in Europe? Do we have to become critically ill before people take us in?
The Italians, what, they're just going to refuse permission for the boat to dock and try and keep it away?
Well, that appears to be the case. Now, recently, earlier this month, the Italian government passed a decree which allows Matteo Salvini to ban boats that are deemed a security risk or a risk to public order. And that's what he did with the Sea-Watch 3. So it's defied that order. He's called it a pirate or delinquent boat. And he said that Italy won't allow its immigration policy to be dictated by a foreign organisation. So the rhetoric is heating up. He's launched a diplomatic protest to the Netherlands. He said that the people on board the ship, because it carries a Dutch flag and it's operated by a German charity, need to take the migrants in. And he's even threatened, because he's saying the European Union has been completely absent on the issue, it's threatened that he may even stop identifying migrants on the European database because of this issue.
Yeah, no sign of this long-running debate being resolved then, because Italy always say these rescue boats encourage migrants to try to head to Europe.
Well, that's Matteo Salvini's line. He says that basically he's saving lives by stopping people smugglers. Now, to a certain extent, there's some truth in that, in that the numbers of migrants crossing on this dangerous route have fallen massively since he's come to power. But the refugee agencies say that actually the route itself is becoming ever more dangerous because of his campaign to stop NGO vessels try to rescue people. And the NGO vessels have had the backing of the UN, saying in the absence of other coordinated European efforts, that they are crucial in saving lives.
Danny Eberhardt. China's attempt to expand its influence in Africa has been dealt a blow after a court in Nairobi blocked plans to build a coal-fired power station near a UNESCO World Heritage site in Kenya. The ruling comes amid concerns over Kenya's ability to repay Chinese loans used to finance another infrastructure project there, a railway from Nairobi to the coastal city of Mombasa. Ahead of the first ever China-Africa Trade Expo this week, our correspondent Anne Soy reports on the impact of Chinese investment in Kenya.
construction work just outside Nairobi. In front of me are dozens of Kenyan workers in yellow helmets. Some are welding, others winch materials using a crane onto one of many tall pillars lined up as far as the eye can see. This is an extension of Kenya's new and much-hyped standard gauge railway, the most expensive project since independence from Britain. The first phase, from the port city of Mombasa to the capital, is already operational. But critics say it was overpriced, and the money being paid to a Chinese firm to run it before it's handed over to Kenya is simply exorbitant. Kwame Owino is a Nairobi-based economist.
Now, the concession agreement requires that this Chinese firm be compensated about 9 million sterling pounds per month for every month for the rest of that 10 years. So if you add that amount to the costs that are already sunk, and you think about the interest rates that Kenya is paying together with the principal amounts, it's unlikely, in our view, that this railway line is ever going to break even.
Yet Kenya is still keen to extend the line, and it's seeking more funds from China this week. A similar request was turned down in April. Infrastructure Minister James Macharia told journalists that the project would terminate, at least for now, in the small town of Naivasha, about 100 kilometres from the capital. From there, it will get connected to the old meter gauge railway.
We have the MGR going all the way to Kampala, you know, which is still active. And so what we are saying is, make that line a lot more viable by connecting it to the SGR in Naivasha. And what we have as number one priority is to make sure that the goods, when they get to Naivasha, they do not get marooned.
The new railway was meant to cut through East Africa to the Atlantic and spur trade. But now, Kenya's neighbours are revisiting their plans. Uganda is refurbishing its Victorian-era line. Back when it was built, the old railway generated controversy in the British Parliament. One MP famously labelled it the Lunatic Line. More than a century later, East Africa's plan for an upgrade is increasingly appearing so.
Welcome, Chengdu Chinese Restaurant.
Over bubbling hot pots of stew, four Chinese businessmen meet at one of their restaurants in Nairobi. China's presence in Africa is growing fast, bringing business and culture. Some view their involvement in Africa with suspicion. The U.S. accuses them of setting debt traps for African governments. Their funding comes without conditions, much to the delight of corrupt officials. But China insists it's here for good.
Our senior Africa correspondent, Anne Soy. The fiancé of the murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi is urging the United Nations to order a criminal investigation into his killing. Hadija Cengiz was speaking as the UN investigator presented her report into his murder. Agnes Callamard repeated her call for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to be investigated. Our correspondent in Geneva, Imogen Folks, sent this report.
The killing of Mr. Khashoggi constituted an extrajudicial execution.
The UN's investigator, Agnes Callamard, was blunt in her assessment. Her findings, she said, point to the premeditated involvement in Jamal Khashoggi's killing of Saudi Arabia's most senior figures.
Credible evidence warranting further investigation of high-level Saudi officials' individual liability, including that of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia.
Listening along with the UN ambassadors was Jamal Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz. Mr. Khashoggi had gone to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to get a visa so they could marry.
At first I thought that maybe something had happened to him, but I never considered for a moment that he would be murdered. I thought maybe the things that Jamal was afraid of were happening, that maybe he'd been arrested, or maybe they were trying to bring him back to Saudi Arabia.
Hatice Cengiz hopes for more sanctions against Saudi Arabia, and she's backing Agnes Callamard's call for a criminal investigation, but that would have to be ordered by the UN Secretary General. Many member states today supported that, but others, among them the United Arab Emirates, joined Saudi Arabia in suggesting the report was weak on evidence and putting their faith in the justice system in Riyadh, A trial of 11 unnamed suspects is currently taking place in Saudi Arabia behind closed doors.
Imogen, folks. The use of computer viruses to extort money from businesses is on the rise, with reports of a 500% increase in ransomware attacks in a year. Large corporations, as well as local government services in the US, have been hit, and it's believed the criminals are being paid ransoms in secret. Our correspondent Joe Tidy visited the international aluminium company Norsk Hydro as it recovered from a global cyber attack.
Glasses.
As well as the usual protective clothing required to visit a modern factory, here, earplugs are essential. An aluminium plant in full swing is deafening. But on one night in March, when hackers struck, everything had to stop. Computer systems went down simultaneously. A ransom note from hackers appeared on screens. Pay us or you'll be locked out forever. And it wasn't just here. Norsk Hydro's 170 sites around the world were all affected. 35,000 employees forced to use pen and paper. It's been 5 weeks now, but production manager Olaf Skulstad describes to me what it was like at his site in Magna, near Norway's eastern border.
This is another one of our computers that went down. Here, everything coming out from the aging oven. You can see which frames coming, which number they have. And
so that was all gone?
All gone.
Thanks to some long-retired workers and some long-forgotten-about paperwork, he managed to keep things running manually, the old-fashioned way. But eventually, things did grind to a halt.
I think it was worse than when the plant started 50 years ago, because at that time it also had some kind of system.
Down here on the factory floor, where these heavy-duty machines are working hand-in-hand with people, every minute counts. You can see why the hackers wanted to target a place like this. I bet they thought they could name their price.
But they never got the chance. At the company's headquarters in Oslo, they took the decision not to negotiate with hackers.
So this is the note here that people would see if they open the file.
So it says, "Greetings, there was a significant flaw in the security system of your company. Your files are encrypted with the strongest military algorithms."
Here was basically the epicenter.
As chief information officer for the company, Jode Vlieger is patiently trying to get the company's systems back up and running.
As we were being attacked, we had to shut down the entire network. 40 countries, 22,000 PCs. And now here we are selectively allowing network communication between people, systems, plants.
So you're very much still recovering from this then?
We're still very much recovering. We don't trust anything.
It's estimated the hackers would have asked for around £300,000 in untraceable Bitcoin. Instead, Norsk Hydro has spent more than $45 million recovering, and they're still months away from finishing.
I think in general it's a very bad idea to pay. It fuels an industry, it's probably financing other sorts of crime.
But there are plenty of companies who are paying and keeping it secret. Sources in the information security industry have described multiple occasions when large, well-known companies have paid huge ransoms and not told the public, shareholders, or even the authorities. To understand the scale of the problem, we need to go to an unlikely part of America. Here, paying hackers ransoms is an open secret.
But there is one firm here in this small town in Connecticut that is happy to speak. They specialise in negotiating the ransoms between the victims and the hackers.
Coveware is just one of a handful of companies that have started helping victims navigate the murky world of cyber extortion. CEO and founder Bill Siegel deals with hackers every day.
We always have at least half a dozen to a dozen cases, public companies and name brands.
Industry analysis suggests that overall, ransomware attack numbers are actually in decline. But some estimates suggest that attacks on businesses have gone up 500% in the last year.
We always want them to be as small as possible or to not happen. But we recognize that when a company needs to pay and it's a large number, then that's what needs to happen. And that can be seven figures. It's not a good outcome, but you're dealing with life and death of the company.
Bill Siegel ending that report by Joe Tidy. And still to come on the podcast.
In Cognac right now, there is a soft revolution. We are starting to study what our forefathers used to do when they were aging cognac. Now you think I'm crazy. It's delicious. It's so refined.
Why France's famous brandy has become a big hit with rappers and hip-hop stars. The Dalai Lama has told the BBC he thinks President Trump lacks moral principle. The Buddhist spiritual leader has been in exile in India since China occupied Tibet in 1959. He talked about how he still hopes to return home one day, calling the Chinese government's thinking very narrow-minded. Rajini Vaidyanathan spoke to him at his home.
So one Chinese official described me as a demon. So then when I first heard that, my response is, yes, I'm demon with horn. Actually, I feel they are political sort of thinking, very narrow-minded.
And that is why I will continue to urge the leaders of China.
In 2007, the Dalai Lama was presented with the Congressional Gold Medal by U.S. President George W. Bush.
His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. I've been pleased to welcome him to the White House.
He also met President Obama on a number of occasions.
You once said that you would be interested in meeting President Trump. Has he ever asked you for a meeting?
No, frankly speaking. His emotion also a little bit too complicated.
What do you mean by that? What do you think of him in office?
One day he says something, another day he says something. But I think lack of moral principle.
One thing that is difficult to sort out at the moment is the situation with Brexit back in the UK. The two sides just cannot come to any agreement. How do they resolve this?
I am one admirer of spirit of European Union. I'm outsider, but I feel better remain in the Union.
You once said that you would be open to a female successor.
That also possible.
You also told one of my colleagues that that female must be attractive, otherwise it's not much
use. Okay, yes.
Can you see why that comment upset a lot of women?
One time. If female Dalai Lama comes and should be more attractive,
a lot of women would say that's objectifying women, and it's about who you are inside, isn't it?
Yes, I think both.
A lot of people say this world today is far less tolerant than it used to be. What would you say to people who are looking for answers?
Many problems is our own creation. We forget oneness of humanity. One world forget. Just my country, my religious faith. Too much emphasis on that.
The Dalai Lama talking to Rajini Vaidyanathan. Qiddiya is a vast entertainment resort planned for near the Saudi capital, Riyadh. It's part of Vision 2030, an ambitious infrastructure project which aims to transform the economy and people's lifestyles. On Wednesday, the master plan for Qiddiya was unveiled, and our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, has been looking at the proposal.
Well, it looks very impressive, but there's nothing actually there at the moment. I was in Saudi Arabia last year and I tried to get to Qiddiya and no journalists were being allowed there. I don't think any work at that point had actually started. So these are artist mock-ups. It's divided into five zones, huge theme parks, water parks, ecological areas, tourist villages, golf courses, as you'd expect, all that kind of stuff, with sort of icing on top of it being high walkways. This is in an escarpment about an hour outside the capital, Riyadh, which is a very dramatic area. I've been there a few times. When you look at pictures of Saudi Arabia and its, you know, natural wonders, that's one of the things that you see. Now, of course, the question mark is how will this affect that area? Because, you know, you're going to have this massive development built. By 2022, when the first phase is supposedly going to be completed, the people running it say they're hoping to host around 1.5 million people there. So this is a radical change, not just, as you were saying, to the economy and lifestyle, but to the actual look of the country, the feel of the country.
And aimed at tourists or Saudis?
Well, the Saudis are selling it as being well beyond the Saudis, although in the first instance, it really is trying to persuade Saudis, as we've spoken before, I think, to stay in Saudi Arabia and spend their money in Saudi Arabia, and also to provide work for young Saudis, provide new opportunities for them, both to feel a part of the country, part of its future, but also, you know, economically, so that they are getting jobs out of it. But it is being sold as, you know, the biggest such development in the Middle East. And remember, this is highly competitive. You've got Dubai, you've got all these other countries who are always fighting each other to build the biggest, the tallest, the most expensive, the most extraordinary.
Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher. The idea that poorer people tend to be the worst affected by climate change is not new. Floods and droughts inevitably have the biggest impact on those living on the cheapest land with the fewest resources. But a UN report suggests that politicians around the world are failing to take this into account. The author is the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, Philip Alston. He spoke to my colleague, Paul Henley.
What I'm trying to give a sense of is the extent to which the impact of climate change is creating a very separate class of winners and losers. The wealthy are able to protect themselves from the worst aspects of climate change and to recover very quickly. The poor are increasingly vulnerable and increasingly likely to be devastated in terms of their lifestyles. So it looks to me as a form of apartheid where you have two completely separate groups that are being treated very differently.
And can you give us some concrete examples of how poorer people, who obviously did least to cause this climate change, are the most affected?
The poor live in the worst areas, the areas that are most susceptible to flooding, to wildfires and to other so-called natural disasters. They lose basically everything they own. They have no resources for recovery. They don't have bank accounts. They don't generally have a social safety net worth talking about. And they're just generally more vulnerable at every level.
But who are you aiming at? Is it governments? Is it multinationals? Is it international human rights movements?
Well, I'm focusing specifically on the human rights community because I think that none of us has done nearly enough as yet. I think that all of the human rights are gravely threatened by climate change. If change is going to come about, it's going to be through social movements, through social mobilisation.
Well, you'll concede that the power and traction of the human rights movement is under some strain at the moment, particularly from populist politicians who think that the Western liberal thing has had its day.
Populists are also the ones who are attacking climate change. It's very easy to attack something that is not absolutely imminent. But I think one of the problems for the human rights movement is that it precisely hasn't engaged sufficiently with these sorts of issues.
Don't you need a narrower focus as a means to an end of your campaign to bring people on board and to kick things into action?
Well, there isn't a single solution, of course, because in any given country, what's got to be worked out is how to move away from fossil fuel reliance, how to start encouraging industries and other activities which use sustainable energy.
But if you could focus on one particular change, it might be more efficient than this basic prophecy of doom.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, of course, the starting point is to say, listen, there's a problem here and you've got to acknowledge it. But I think you're right. Sending a negative message of this sort is perhaps more easily dismissed by those who simply don't want to confront the harsh realities. There are many others working in the climate change area who have put forward lots of proposals. And I think the new green economy, for example, is one such proposal that's coming up.
Philip Alston. It was officially released in 2001, but the Japanese animated film Spirited Away is cleaning up at the box office in China, taking more than twice as much as the Hollywood blockbuster Toy Story 4. And that despite the fact that many viewers there have already seen pirated versions of Spirited Away, not to mention China's historical animosity towards Japan. So what's going on? I spoke to our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
At the end of last year, the Studio Ghibli company decided to release in China the film My Neighbor Totoro, and it was a huge sensation. It did very, very well at the Chinese box office. And decades ago, China and Japan were like sworn enemies. So to have access to anything Japanese, I mean, even something like this that's quite cute, an animation, was seen as slightly subversive and quite exciting. So a lot of people had seen it at the time. They managed to get hold of bootleg copies, or they just wanted to... Yeah, they were just excited about being able to have a big Totoro toy. And people want to go and see it in the cinema and have that experience all over again.
And in the same way that they'd seen My Neighbor Totoro on what pirated DVDs, they've seen Spirited Away already, but they want to see it on the big screen.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, I remember when My Neighbor Totoro came out in December, people were sharing pictures of their cinema tickets. You know, it was a really exciting thing. I mean, even though the film was released over 20 years ago, it's a nostalgia thing. It's, I remember this back in the day. Can go with all my friends. Can, you know, we can remember this all over again. And people have been sharing their pictures again of their cinema tickets and saying that it's brilliant. And just generally, anyway, the idea that you could go and see a Japanese film in the cinema is quite exciting, that a lot of people in China feel that domestic productions are just not up to the standards of other countries. So this is a film that was acclaimed when it first came out. And even though it's an old film, yeah, people loved the idea that they could go and see something like this. It's still very, very powerful and still has a huge impact.
Does it signal a change by the Chinese authorities or even the Chinese people to welcoming Japanese films and culture?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, ever since Xi Jinping came into power, he's made efforts to through various initiatives and various schemes to improve connections with Shinzo Abe in Japan. I mean, the idea that they could even stand in the same room and shake hands was a big deal in China. But also, I mean, this ties into the whole US-China trade spat as well, because, you know, previously it used to be that China and the US were quite close, but China's now trying to look more towards the east and its connections with countries that are close to it. And as relationships are getting better between China and Japan, there's opportunities for more Japanese culture to come back within the mainland. People are very enthusiastic about this and quite excited.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. What do you think of when you hear the word cognac? Perhaps, my producer tells me, it calls to mind the light of a log fire reflected in a piece of expensive glassware with classical music playing softly in the background. But it seems the reality is actually that a modern cognac drinker is far more likely to be listening to this. Cognac, brandy exclusively from the cognac region of France, is, it seems, more popular with American hip-hop and rap fans than practically anyone else on the planet, as Elizabeth Hodson reports. I need a one dance,
got a Hennessy in my hand. Last year, nearly 98% of cognac was exported, and by far the biggest market is the USA. And in large part, the industry has got American rap and hip-hop music to thank.
The ultimate cognac theme song was Busta Rhymes and Pharrell and Diddy with Passa Cavarsie.
Candace McDuffie is a music journalist from Boston.
Kanye was infamously drinking Hennessy at the MTV 2009 Video Music Awards right before he interrupted Taylor Swift and had that whole controversy surrounding him. It's really been a staple in the black community, and I think it's important to remember that rap music and hip-hop was always about black struggle, and Hennessy is so important to black people because of their connections to us historically, right? During the time where segregation was still legal, they hired a black marketing vice president, which was huge. They were the first cognac advertised in two historical black publications, Ebony and Jet.
But whilst cognac sales are growing in the US, in Europe, fewer bottles were shipped last year than in 2017. At the recent cognac show in London, I met Dawn Davis, head buyer at the Whiskey Exchange, which, despite its name, also sells a lot of cognac.
For me, about 5 years ago, the cognac producers got quite complacent about the UK. The UK has been a very strong market for them for a very long time. We have a huge history of cognac.
What about the French consumers? Because French people drink a lot more whiskey than they do cognac.
Absolutely. And I think cognac in itself, sort of 5 years ago, was very static as a category. There was no innovation. There was no kind of drive. They were very much looking outside of the European market. And I think what's really interesting now is suddenly they've woken up. Whiskey is such a huge category, gin. So now I think what we're seeing is the houses are really starting to open their eyes and try new things.
And in the hallowed vineyards of cognac, revolution is in the air.
I am Alexandre Gabriel, owner and master blender at Maison Ferrand, making cognac Ferrand. In cognac right now, there is a soft revolution. We are starting to study what our forefathers used to do when they were aging cognac in a wine barrel, in a Sauternes barrel. Cognac legally right now has to be aged only in oak barrels. I've gone another way, making barrels in a chestnut tree. Now you think I'm crazy. It's delicious. It's so refined. So our Renegade barrel number 2 is aged in a chestnut barrel, but by law, I cannot call it cognac. Regulation needs to be evolving.
If changing the type of wood in barrel aging is considered incendiary, I wonder what the denizens of Cognac would think of East London cocktail bar Satan's Whiskers, where General Manager Joe Hall is really shaking things up.
We'll make a straight flush, which is a lighter style cognac drink. We've got two strawberries here, fresh lemon juice, sugar syrup, fresh grapefruit juice, 15 millilitres of Aperol, a healthy 40 millilitres of our house cognac, which is Martell VSOP. So we'll give that a shake and put it on the rocks with a grapefruit slice and some mint.
I've brought along one of my friends because she's not a cognac drinker, and I'd be interested to see what she thinks of a cognac cocktail.
I don't drink cognac. Find it a little bit scary, associate it as a bit of an old man's drink.
All right, so we'll strain that off into a very traditional cocktail glass. There we go, that's the straight flush.
That's delicious, really fresh. Like, it's got lovely kind of springtime vibes to it. And yeah, I love the presentation. Like, the little bouquet of mint and the grapefruit on the side makes it look really tropical.
And maybe with this fresh new image, Cognac will be able to revive its European fortunes.
Elizabeth Hodson reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Death in Ice Valley is back.
She was laying with her head down there.
Fake passports, the wigs, the unprescripted glasses.
There are somebody living who knows more about this case.
I'm Maria Tigroff.
And I'm Neil McCarthy.
And we've been trying to find answers to an unsolved mystery.
Why all this secrecy?
It was like a cover-up.
Now, 1 year on, we're back with an update on the case.
Yes, with new leads to follow from you, our listeners.
This is maybe the first lead of evidence we have in almost 48 years.
More on the original investigation.
They were being told, don't work it anymore, or don't go into that.
And maybe even a brand new eyewitness.
I feel I met this lady. That's a special episode of Death in Ice Valley, recorded live in Bergen in Norway from the BBC World Service and NRK.
Catch up with the whole series now, and you'll also find our new episode.
Just search for Death in Ice Valley wherever you get your podcasts.